am a PhD student at Virginia Tech currently. Some of you might know my advisor, Dr. Bill Hopkins. I want to acknowledge him right off the bat for just being so encouraging and working with me. I've been trying to get to Virginia to work with the species for several years now, and he's been super supportive, and we finally managed to wrangle some funds to do it recently through DGIF. So I'm excited to be here working in the state. I really did put together a very general presentation since I haven't really started my PhD work yet. I'm in my first field season. I don't have any graphs or data to show you, but I hope to kind of give some of you who don't know much about the species a better understanding of how it might be affected by some of the issues that I'm sure many of you think about and what's going on with the species in Virginia. So the hellbender, really cool species that I've been working with for several years now. Some things that you need to know right off the bat. This is a fully aquatic salamander. So hellbenders, they're also a large salamander, I should say. They can reach up to 2.5 feet in total length. They're fully aquatic. They don't leave flowing water systems, so they're confined to the stream their entire life. They're habitat specialists. We typically think of hellbenders as being associated with clean, cool, habitats. They obtain all their oxygen cutaneously, so they need a high level of dissolved oxygen. They are specialists, they specialize on prey as their primary prey item, and they rely on rock crevices for day-to-day use. So you're really lucky if you've ever seen a hellbender sitting out in the open. More often you find them hiding beneath a rock or in a bedrock crevice. So they really require those crevices for protection from predators, and especially for specific nesting cavities that they use for spawning in fall. They're a long-lived species. We know that hellbenders can live over 25 years in the wild, probably over 40 years. And they show a very high degree of site fidelity to specific stream segments and also specific rocks within those stream segments. So for example, if you were to find a hellbender under a rock in a stream near your house, and you made sure to kind of replace that rock exactly how it was, and you came back in 10 years, there's a really good chance the hellbender you found under that rock is under that rock still or in close proximity. So I think collectively, the things I want to impress upon you is this animal requires very specific habitat requirements over a very long period of time, and those resources need to be very predictable for this species to really blossom, I guess, in the wild environment. So one of the most fun things about working with a species is the range of amazing nicknames they get that you hear from locals. When I work with private landowners, I'm always excited to hear what they think of the hellbender. So Old Lasagna Sides is my all-time favorite. Snot Otter is another good one. I get a lot of Mud Dog around. I've been up in Walker Creek Valley lately, and I get a lot of Mud Dog comments. But you know, there are several of these. Grampus is another one we hear in the southern part of Virginia. The hellbender, I mentioned, was a very large, relatively large species of salamander. But there are other native species of salamanders that are fully aquatic that rival it in total length. The mud puppy is the most common species that's confused with the hellbender. So when I hear from people that they've seen a hellbender, I always ask them if they've seen those external gills. That's the biggest distinguishing factor that's been helped discriminate between the two. Mud puppies do retain their gills their entire life. Hellbenders lose them at just a few centimeters total length. So they go through metamorphosis and they have no gills as adults. I want to share with you a couple important aspects of this animal's life cycle that make it pretty unique and fun to study. Primarily, adults are solitary animals. I mentioned they hide under rocks in these rock crevices, and they really don't congregate with one another from what we know. They do congregate about once a year for breeding, which takes place in late summer or autumn. A male will typically establish a nest crevice under a big rock, and it's usually a very specific cavity. And we don't know a whole lot about this, but from anecdotal accounts, it seems that there has to be enough space under this rock to afford a pretty large egg mass to be maintained along with that male. And there needs to be one opening that can be guarded really well over the incubation period. So the males will establish these cavities, females and males will migrate to these cavities, probably based on a temperature cue in autumn, and multiple females might deposit eggs, multiple males might attempt to fertilize those eggs externally, and the male that has established that den probably kicks everybody out as soon as possible so that he can dominate the egg mass and protect it from predators. So they do show paternal care. This is a picture of a hellbender egg mass. There were about 1,200 eggs in this mass. This was actually collected from Missouri, where I was working previously. But those eggs will remain in that cavity for about 60 days until hatching. And the male does stay with them. At hatching, larval hellbenders have pretty much no pigment. They have a big yolk sac. They're virtually helpless. They kind of flop around and wiggle on their sides. At which time the male is still again guarding them. After a few weeks, they'll develop kind of that darker pigment and develop better formed limbs. At this point, they can kind of burrow down into gravelly substrate where their interstitial space is. And at some point, they emerge from this nest, but we really don't know much about this at all, when that happens and how far they go when they do. At about a year of age, they'll actually absorb those gills and go through this metamorphosis, at which time they're considered a juvenile, and it'll take another 4 to 6 years for them to actually reach sexual maturity. People are often impressed when I point out to them the historic native range of the species. It's relatively widespread, ranging from up there in New York, south all the way to extreme northern Mississippi and Alabama, and as far west into Missouri. I just want to briefly mention there are two recognized subspecies of hellbenders right now. The eastern makes up most of the range, but that little pink blob is the range of the Ozark hellbender in very southern Missouri and northern Arkansas. There are 16 states within that native range where hellbenders historically existed. Three of those states consider hellbender populations to be functionally extinct or extirpated. Seven of those states consider populations to have declined dramatically and currently be at risk of extinction. And in particular, because that Ozark hellbender has such a small endemic range, the documentation of these declines has led to its federal listing as an endangered species under the ESA as recently as 2011. Now, right now, the eastern hellbender, any protection it receives is on a state-by-state basis. It's being examined as a possible candidate for federal listing under the ESA, but we really don't know enough about its status to decide whether or not to warrant it. So, briefly, the blue states here are states where hellbenders are considered rare and a species of concern, but the states view those populations as stable. And then in the core of the species range, we really don't know anything. Okay, these are states, Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, and Virginia. There might have been a few surveys, but these are big knowledge gaps concerning the status of this animal. And so for conservation reasons, it's a priority to kind of find out what's going on in these states. And note that Virginia, Southwest Virginia, is an important component of that. So briefly, before I talk about Virginia, just want to go over some of the suspected reasons we do think the species is declining across the range. Most importantly, we think habitat loss is a major player, particularly deposition of very fine sediments that fill those interstitial spaces these animals rely on a day-to-day basis. So addition to fine sediment, also water quality alterations, and particularly in terms of thermal regimes in rivers could be important. Clearing of that riparian vegetation, particularly in tributaries and headwater streams, could have a big impact on this. And those are the major players. There are concerns of suspect disease, in particular the amphibian chytrid fungus. I'm not sure how familiar you all might be, but this is a fungus that infects amphibian epidermis. It's been implicated in massive die-offs of frogs, typically, in Central America and Australia, and even the Western United States. We do know hellbenders carry it, but there seems to be some variability in how they respond. So sometimes they experience mortality, other times they seem to carry that fungus and they can clear infection after a certain period of time. introduced predators are another concern. In some, most cases, this is in reference to introduction of non-native trout species to Hellbender waters. So here we have the native brook trout, but introduction of those rainbows and brown trouts, those big voracious predators, we think might be having an effect on larval survivorship, making it to that reproductive maturity life stage. And we also think that persecution of these animals might have had a big impact in some places, and illegal and unregulated collections. One of the most common stories I hear when I meet people who have heard of mud dogs or remember seeing them as a kid, they tell me, oh yeah, we used to catch them and we used to drive a stake through their heads. I've heard that several places, so it's hard to hear, but apparently there's a lot of misunderstanding that these animals are eating fish, and they, I try to share with them that crayfish is what they're after. Okay, so in Virginia, what do we know about hellbenders? So the shaded area here shows you the native range of the species in the state, and you can see that the New River drainage makes up a significant portion of that. And right now, Virginia recognizes the hellbender as a species of conservation concern, but we know very little about where hellbenders occur in this New River drainage. It really has been overlooked. Seeing as it's such a big part of this historic range, I was really excited to move to Virginia and start looking at some questions. So our research focus is really to look at where hellbenders still might occur in the New River, the main stem, as well as several of its tributaries. And secondly, how do human activities on the landscape, how might they be influencing the ability of these animals to survive? Briefly, how we survey. So in case you're ever driving by a stream and you see a bunch of hooligans in wetsuits, it's a lot of fun to go out there and help in their survey. We use snorkeling techniques primarily, and we actually go out removing these really large rocks. Sometimes we use these log peavies. You can see in the upper left-hand photo, one person's lifting a rock, and a bunch of us other fools are sticking our arms and heads under it. So I think of hellbender surveys as a team building and trust building. We also use noodling, believe it or not. You can see the guy in the upper right is kind of noodling under a rock. This is, especially when you're looking for a big salamander, they need a certain size opening to get in, and it's usually about the right size for you to fit a hand in. So you never know what you're going to get, but sometimes this is really effective finding these animals. When we capture hellbenders, we're processing them, getting basic measurements on length and weight and sex. We're also implanting them. In the image on the lower left, you can see this animal's getting a passive integrated transponder, a tag implant, a pit tag that we use for a unique identifier. So when we go back, we can tell whether we captured these animals previously or not. And then we'll do some scanning in the lower right. This is a picture of a swab method we use to look for that fungus that I mentioned earlier. Sometimes we'll take blood samples and whatnot. And then we release them under the rock where we found them. So what are we looking for? When we go out and survey reaches a stream, there are some characteristics that sometimes jump right out that tell you whether you might be looking at a healthy population or subpopulation. In particular, if you get a lot of animals, that's always a good sign, but it's really exciting when we find large and small animals together. Very commonly, if I were to show you data from the states where hellbenders have declined pretty dramatically, you can see this shift. It's very dramatic from kind of a nice distribution of animals from all size classes, from the little to the great big. And in 10 years or so later, you see that shift towards you're just catching really large, mature individuals, and you're really missing those younger age classes. And so for that reason, a lot of people suspect that there's something going on with reproduction. Possibly it's just lack of appropriate nesting habitat that's affecting these animals. So as exciting as it is to pull out 2.5 foot long salamander from a rock, I get super excited when I catch the little guys. You can't wipe the smile off my face. Okay, so I mentioned I don't have a lot of data to show you, but we did do a couple preliminary surveys that we were really excited about that I want to share with you. These took place on the main stem New River. To give you an idea of locality, this is roughly between Whitethorn Boat Landing and kind of the Big Falls area. And so we went out, we snorkeled, used a snorkeling survey technique to survey two different sites. We did detect hellbenders at one of those two sites. and we were able to capture four individuals there. This was a whole day of snorkeling with probably six people. So we caught three males, one female. These were large, just massive individuals, some of the largest I've seen, 55 to 63 centimeters in total length. To give you an idea, these animals were probably well over 25 years old, and they ranged from 700 up to over a kilogram in body mass. So it was really exciting because this was kind of the first time we've established there seem to be animals that are residing in the main Stebbing River, and it kind of surprised us because the water temperatures out there do get pretty warm in the summertime. But these weren't at a tributary mouth or anything, these were in the main stem of the river, so we were excited about it. To give you an idea of what we're looking at in the future, this summer I'm spending almost all of my time surveying about 35 additional sites just in the New River drainage. Some of the major tributaries, looking for these animals. I'm going back to these sites three times, kind of in an occupancy modeling approach to try to figure out where these species might occur and what landscape factors might influence their occurrence. And then I'm hoping to identify a subset of sites within this broader area that I'm going to be looking at more intensively over the next 3 years to monitor and look at things like abundance and survivorship and possibly reproductive success from year to year. So, those are my goals for the future. That being said, I'm always excited about finding new locations where there are a good number of these animals. So if you've got hellbenders or you know someone who does, send me an email. I would love to come out and check out your section stream, or if you have an anecdotal account of someone who's mentioned they've seen these animals, I'd love to hear about it. And with that, I just want to acknowledge again all my committee members, one of which, Paul Mayermeyer, is here today. They're at Virginia Tech. These people have been great and kind of encouraging me along my path. And the funding for all my research comes from Virginia Department of Game and Fisheries.